This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing. Your numbers are 297-5633 locally, and outside the Baton Rouge area, 877-217-5757. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Yale University psychology professor John Barge on his book, Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do. Barge is recognized as a leading authority on the study of the unconscious mind. And Sally Quinn, the veteran journalist and widow of Ben Bradley, will comment on her memoir, Finding Magic. And a reminder that at 2 o'clock today, Governor John Bel Edwards will be here for his monthly radio show. And one of the topics he's bound to talk about is this controversy swirling about the sheriff in Caddo Parish, Steve Prater, who, according to most people in that area, is one of the most popular officials in Caddo Parish. But he put his foot in his mouth in a big way a few days ago. And Ali Baltazar, do we have the tape? Let's listen to Steve Prater talking about inmate labor.
Place out there. I don't want state prisoners, okay? They are a necessary evil to keep the doors open, that we keep a few or keep some out there. And that's the ones that you can work. That's the ones that can pick up trash, the work release programs. But guess what? Those are the ones that they're releasing. In addition to the bad ones, and I call these bad, in addition to them, they're releasing some good ones that we use every day to wash cars, to change oil in our cars, to cook in the kitchen, to do all that where we save money. Well, they're going to let them out.
All right. Tom Haswell is with us, the publisher of Louisiana Voice the last 7 years, and he's written about this on his website. And this is a kind of a statement that would undo a lot of public officials, apparently not Sheriff Prater. But what do you make of this?
Well, first of all, it's Shreveport. That's a whole other world.
Really?
I think it was a very ill-advised thing to say. I mean, it was asinine. I mean, who does he want to turn loose? The violent offenders? I mean, that's the alternative. And we need to reduce the prison population in this state. We have the highest prison population in the world. And to make a statement like that is just irrational and certainly, well, for lack of a better word, stupid.
Well, it's gotten a lot of play nationally, in addition to maybe more nationally than locally, but I would imagine Sheriff Prater will move merrily along. But it brings up a discussion about inmate labor, and some are calling this modern-day slavery.
Absolutely. I just had a blog post about it earlier this week or late last week, I forget, and it was picked up by a national news organization that specializes in prison news, and it is a form of slavery. It harkens back to the convict leasing that began in Louisiana in 1841, predated the Civil War by 20 years. And they would lease out these prisoners to private concerns to do work, build mm-hmm. railroads, what have you. And they were mistreated horribly. I mean, they were served food that was crawling in worms. I mean, it was just a horrendous thing to do. And then, of course, the other southern states followed suit after the Civil War when slavery was abolished by the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863. This was simply something to replace slavery with another form of slavery. And it's carried forward to today. Now it's businesses that use prison labor, are given a $2,400 tax exemption, reduction.
Credit,
that's the word I'm looking for. Thank you, Jim. They've a flat $2,400 tax credit for every prisoner. Now, the chicken farm up in Farmerville in Union Parish uses 200 prisoners in their work release program. That's a $480,000 tax credit right off the top, costing the state of Louisiana.
877-217-5757. As I mentioned, Governor John Bel Edwards will be here, and I'm told that he's actually going to bring Sheriff Kaz from across the river over with him today. So we'll be right where you are, Tom, and we'll certainly talk about this and more with Governor Edwards today at 2 o'clock right here on WRKF. A listener already has sent an email to Tom Aswell, who covers state politics, about the treasurer's race. Any surprise that John Schroeder is in a runoff with Derek Edwards?
Not really. I think Angela Davis's ads where she tried to jump on the Trump bandwagon. I think that kind of backfired with her. I don't think that was a wise thing for her to do. And plus, she was tied to the Jindal administration. And Neil Reiser, of course, was the author of the infamous Edmondson amendment back in 2014. So I think those things considered, I think Schroeder was a strong candidate, mm-hmm. and he's now pitted against Edwards, the Democrat from New Orleans, who is a CPA and an attorney. So I mean, he's got creds. He just doesn't have any money.
Well, hopefully he'll do some interviews. He didn't do any the primary season, and I guess he didn't feel like he had to. But if he wants to win, he's got to do a lot of interviews.
He's going to have to get some money too. The Democratic Party is going to have to support him if he has a chance.
And it's going to be a near impossible.
He got all the votes he's going to get. Really, realistically speaking.
Mm-hmm. Now Neil Reiser thought he was going to chip into the support that Derek Edwards received in New Orleans. Reiser ended up getting 12% of the votes in Orleans Parish and spent $58,000 there on a lot of these political organizations. Some of whom some highly ranked Democrats, including the chair of the party, are affiliated with, didn't do Neil Reiser a lot of good, did it?
No. And it didn't help Angel to do that robocall ad that she had in New Orleans, too, where she was trying to push the Democrat. She was pushing him, Edwards, as a counter
really?
To Neil Reiser.
Really?
Yeah.
And I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, it was typical Louisiana politics.
it is interesting how you campaign one way in one place and another in a different place.
Oh, absolutely.
In fact, I heard a story recently about an old race for a city court here in Baton Rouge about 30 years ago in which a candidate was on the urban stations saying one thing. And her opponent bought the spot and then ended up playing it on the country station and the the talk station, and it cost this candidate the election.
Yep.
So the message was not tailored to a broad audience. It was tailored to a narrow audience, but other people
but
heard.
But it reached a broad audience.
Yeah, and it didn't work out the way it was intended. But the turnout, Tom, 13.5%.
Yeah, well, it was predicted at 14%, so they were pretty close.
Yeah.
That's abysmal. That's horrible. We get the kind of government we deserve in this state because of something like that.
Well, you think 400,000 people out of 3 million registered voters?
Absolutely. It's pitiful. It's really bad.
And John Schroeder, and this is an important office, treasurer, he made the runoff with 96,000 votes. So
yeah.
do the math on that.
And Schroeder, by the way, if people have forgotten, is the one who authored, I think, three bills in 2010, which gave birth to Louisiana Voice. He authored three bills to abolish civil service, and that got my dander up, and I started Louisiana Voice as a result of that.
And now it's a must-read for people who either like you or don't like you, and I hope you have a fund for legal defense because you have been sued a time or two.
Well, we're not going to talk about that. Yeah, I have been sued. I won it. It was a libel suit that I won. The judge threw it out. And now the person who brought the suit has got to pay my attorney fees. But I don't want to go into that. That's not something I care to talk about.
All right. Are you at liberty to talk about this other story regarding the suit against one of our local television stations?
I can talk about it a little bit. I don't know a whole lot about it. I just know that it came down, I think, yesterday. A state trooper named Robert Burns sued WBRZ for libel. And WBRZ, by the way, Robert Burns was accused of doing the same thing that Painter Murphy Painter was accused of doing, and that's logging into the data system, and it was supposed to be something about his ex-wife or something. I don't know the details. But he sued Nakamoto, Chris Nakamoto.
Well, he sued the station, didn't he?
No.
He didn't sue him personally, did he?
Yeah, sued him personally and sued WBRZ television. And WBRZ, for unknown reasons, failed to answer the suit, and the judge entered a default judgment of $2.5 million.
That's a lot of money. I would imagine there's an appeal coming very soon, as in right now.
I'll bet you they respond now.
I would think so. 877-217-5757 is your number. Your local dial is 297-5633 for Tom Aswell. The last 7 years, each day he does his reports on Louisiana Voice. This is a man who for many years was a reporter based in the north country of Ruston. And that's another question from a listener, is that all of our statewide officials are based in South Louisiana now.
That's where the votes are.
There aren't any north of I-10, I don't think.
Other
than John Bell Edwards.
I remember the day when, as Earl Long would call him, Della Soups Morrison would get into the runoff for governor, and then the North Louisiana candidate would wax his floors for him and beat him in the runoff.
Well, we'll return with Tom Aswell and spend some more time with this interesting character and journalist. 877-217-5757, your number. We're back after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Allie Baltazar is producing. Tom Aswell's our guest for another segment. Not only the publisher of Louisiana Voice, but recently he wrote the definitive biography about Bobby Jindal, and I'm not kidding, it's the best book yet written about our former governor, Bobby Jindal, His Destiny and Obsession. 877-217-5757 if you'd like to talk with Tom, and talk at talklouisiana.org for emails. Bobby Jindal, some believe, is still possibly in the hunt to be health secretary under President Trump. Any chance?
No.
No?
No.
Why?
Trump doesn't even know who Bobby Jindal is.
Oh, I'm sure he knows who he is. Come on, Tom.
No, I don't think Jindal has a shot at any national office now.
Even an appointed one?
No.
Okay. Well, the president warned Senator McCain that he fights back, and this is because those two are disagreeing. McCain, a former Navy pilot, has spent 5.5 years in a Vietnam prisoner of war camp and is battling glioblastoma, the most deadly form of brain cancer, offered a response to Mr. Trump saying, "I have faced tougher adversaries." Tom Aswell, your thoughts?
Well, what are they fighting about this time?
Well, Senator McCain made some remarks that the president didn't like, and this caused the outburst from Donald Trump, who, as we know, does not let things go quietly.
No, he doesn't. He has a very thin skin. He, man, scares me to death, actually. But I think he's picking on the wrong person when he picks on Trump. I mean, the man has terminal cancer.
McCain.
The man has terminal cancer. You don't pick on people like that. And he's a war hero. You don't pick on people like that. Trump needs to pick his fights a little better.
Well, the remarks from Senator McCain, which sent the president into orbit, were to abandon the ideals we have advanced around the globe, to refuse the obligations of international leadership for the sake of some half-baked, spurious nationalism cooked up by people who would rather find scapegoats than solve problems, is as unpatriotic as an attachment to any other tired dogma of the past that Americans can sign to the ash heap of history. That's what sent the president into this I fight back response.
Well, I can understand that, but I happen to agree with McCain on this particular issue. I don't agree with McCain on everything, but I certainly agree with him on this. The idea of this treaty with Iran, the decertification of it. I don't know what Trump's end game is here. We're telling the world that our word doesn't mean anything, and that can't be good.
Well, remember, then candidate Donald Trump said of John McCain that he wasn't a hero because he was captured.
Yep.
And this
right.
is from a man who took 5 draft deferments.
Exactly.
Yep. You served in the Vietnam era.
I served in the Vietnam era. I didn't go to Vietnam. I was stateside the whole time, and there were no attacks on the mainland, so there you go.
But you served.
Yeah.
And you didn't get out because of bone spurs.
Right.
Okay. Listener also wants to know about the book that you helped write. I think you edited, actually, the Barry Seal book.
I did edit Smuggler's End.
Smuggler's End with Del Hahn.
Del Hahn, very, very wonderful gentleman.
Edited by Tom Aswell. And Tom, the movie is American Made, which is probably showing for the final week here in Baton Rouge.
Let's hope so.
You didn't like it. Why not?
Terrible.
Why did you not like that film?
Well, there were three things. First of all, the first thing you see on the screen when the movie opens is based on a true story. And now I'll always question when I see that in any movie, how true is it? This movie was true in three respects. The gentleman's name was Barry Seal. He was from Baton Rouge, and he was a drug smuggler. After that, the movie is pure fiction.
Doesn't Tom Cruise look a lot like Barry?
Oh, sure. Pot belly and all. No, it was a horrible movie. It had him moving to Mena, Arkansas. They never moved to Mena, Arkansas. Barry didn't. It had him being arrested in Arkansas. He was never arrested in Arkansas. Had the attorney, it was a, the arrest was by four simultaneous raids by four separate agencies, DEA, ATF, FBI, and Arkansas State Police. And in the movie, Governor Bill Clinton calls the attorney general and has all these agencies stand down. Now, how can a governor get three straight agencies, federal agencies, to stand down? It doesn't happen. The movie is just, it's fantasy. It's awful.
Well, I don't know that it's done that well at the box office, but it has gotten mixed reviews. Not bad in some cases. Cruise is certainly a compelling actor.
Well, for entertainment purposes, it's okay.
If you didn't know the real story, you might have a different feeling about it.
Well, you can still, even if you don't know the real story, you can see some of the embellishment. It's just, I mean, it's just there. It's just obvious.
All right. Does the end have Barry Seal killed at the halfway house in Baton Rouge?
Yes. And that's another thing. It was an Arkansas judge, state judge, who sentenced him to the halfway house in Baton Rouge.
That would make you wonder. Okay. Another listener asked about 2019. We're 2 years away from a governor's election. 2 years away.
Yes.
It's John Bel Edwards. We know he's running, and we know he's going to get at least 31% of the votes, Tom Aswell, based on what happened in the treasurer's race. My guess is that he'll get a lot more. He got 40% in the primary 2 years ago. Who's his most likely opponent?
I think John Kennedy is. At one time, I thought Jeff Landry, but I think I see his star fading somewhat.
And Kennedy is raising money, and he's sending out press releases attacking our governor as a man who never met a tax he didn't like.
Yep.
Is that fair?
Nope.
Why?
How can you make a blanket statement like that? I mean, that's
what is politics?
Politics? Well, yeah, you got a point there. But
it's funny. I remember John Kennedy as the mastermind behind Buddy Romer's fiscal reform package, which included a lot of new taxes back in 1989, it went down to defeat 55-45 with state voters, but many of us thought that was actually a good plan, including me. But now John Kennedy is one who he's acting as though he's never favored a tax.
Well, John Kennedy was a Democrat back then too. John Kennedy, when he was Secretary of Revenue, ran for treasurer. And had an ad saying that when he was Secretary of Revenue, he reduced paperwork for small businesses by 150%. Now, do the math on that. How do you reduce anything by 150%?
You can only reduce it 100% at the most.
And I called his campaign headquarters because I'm the kind of guy that does that. And I posed that question to him, and they didn't get it at first. And then I finally said, well, no, you're misunderstanding me. I said, how do you reduce anything more than 100%? Because then you're at zero. And I said, and this is a guy that wants to handle our finances? And they hung up on me. But they but they pulled the ad that night.
Well, it's kind of like people say, it's usually football coaches, we're going to give 110% or 130%.
Absolutely.
How can you give more than 100%?
Well, that wasn't a cliche. That was just a serious era in mathematics.
From the bean counter.
Yeah.
In the state of Louisiana.
Correct.
Well, but Kennedy, John Kennedy, Senator Kennedy, he will be a formidable candidate if he gets in the race. I don't think there's any question he could win it.
Well, with his down-home approach, that appeals to some people.
What is it about the governor's office that is so appealing? In most states, being a U.S. senator is superior because you get a six-year term. You don't get the day-to-day headaches you have as governor. But in Louisiana, as Doug Morrow, our former DA, said, the governor's office is the big enchilada. Why?
Well, I think you boil it down to one thing. In the Senate, you're one of 100, and Governor, you're the top dog, just like Morrow said. But when you're one of 100 with no seniority, you don't have a lot of clout.
But in Louisiana, you're top dog of a state that has fewer people than metropolitan Houston.
I understand
but
that.
Still,
but you're still
if you're
the
a
top
Louisiana
dog.
Boy, and he kind of is, even though he was born in Centerville, Mississippi. John Kennedy, like John Bell Edwards, and like Edwin Edwards, and like Buddy Romer, they all want to be governor.
Well, it's the same thing that Harry Lee said one time when he was asked about running for governor, and he said he has a better position as sheriff of Jefferson Parish.
You know, Edwin Edwards said that being governor of Louisiana was better than being president of the United States.
Yeah, well, more graft.
Well, another governor didn't feel that way, though. And he spent 8 years running for president and got zero delegates.
Exactly.
Zero.
Yep.
Thank you, Tom Aswell. Always a pleasure to see you. And we're back after this brief pause with John Barge. His book is Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do. Now the news with Karen Henderson on WRKN. This is Jim Inkster, and our guest at this time is a man recognized as the world's leading expert on the unconscious mind. And he reveals the hidden mental processes that secretly govern every aspect of our behavior. His book is Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do. John Barge is with us, social and cognitive psychologist, and a man who is renowned, as I said, in his field, like few others, for more than three decades. He's been conducting revolutionary research into the unconscious mind. And this is something that many of us have an interest in, but few of us have authority to talk about, as you do. What is it about the unconscious mind that rules what we do in the world as we know it?
Well, Jim, thanks first for having me on. The book is in the bookstores today, and I'm real excited. And you're my first interview, so I'm a little nervous, but I know from your reputation you're going to make it really easy for me. And the book is about the unconscious influences that underlie what we think and feel and do. And it's really a new version of the unconscious. It's not the old Freudian one. And I know a lot of people saw the movie Inside Out, you know, the animated movie a few years ago. And if you remember, there's a scene there where a bad emotion does something wrong and gets thrown into this box called the unconscious, and they lock the door, and you never see them again. And it's like this unlocked door where things are happening that we have no idea what's going on. It's malevolent. It's this sort of a version of the Freudian unconscious of self-destructive impulses and bad things. And what the science has actually shown in the last 40 years, since the 70s and 80s, is really that it's the same mind. We don't have a separate mind in our head, and it's not the source of evil and the source of bad things. It's really there to help us, and in many ways it's helping us attain our goals and working on things behind the scenes to do the things that we want to do. And it's very adaptive. It keeps us safe. It's all about physical safety. It's all about our basic useful motivations. And it's not totally helpful. There's some problems with it, just like there's problems with conscious thinking. But it's not the source of evil and bad things as it used to be portrayed. And the key here is to understand how it works, because there are practical implications for knowing how it works. And I think that once we accept that these things are happening and know how they happen, we can take more control over our lives.
Why has the Freudian concept of the unconscious been accepted so universally through the years?
That's a really good question. That's an excellent question. It turned out it was just sort of a fluke that it happened, because at the time, Freud was trying to understand the physical causes of mental illness. And before Freud, it was all seen as demonic possession, that evil spirits were in the person, causing them to behave in these bizarre ways that were antisocial and different from everybody else. And Freud was trying to take these problems seriously and try to find the physical causes as a medical doctor. And at the same time, another doctor, Pierre Janet, was doing the same thing Freud was doing. And they came to very different conclusions. They both agreed that there were these causes inside the mind. But Pierre Janet thought that these were abnormal problems that only a certain people had. And Freud said, no, these problems are true of everybody. We all have them. And so he generalized from these case studies of these basically mentally ill people to normal human functioning for everybody. And Genet strongly disagreed, and yet it was Freud's version that won the day. Freud was a brilliant genius of a thinker and scholar, and his books were very influential. And it sort of caught on in the culture, this idea of a separate mind. It also, I hate to say it, Jim, but, you know, this gives us a very convenient excuse for anything that happens wrong. It's like we used to say, you know, the devil made me do it, like Flip Wilson, you know, the old the comedian from the 60s and 70s. Like, Geraldine, you know, why'd you spend the rent money on that new dress? Oh, the devil made me do it. The devil made me do it. So it's a nice excuse to say when anything happens that maybe didn't work out so well, that it was my unconscious, you know, that caused me to say those things to you or to do the bad thing. And it's really a nice way of avoiding responsibility for things.
The book is Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do, from Dr. John Barge, and Malcolm Gladwell says that he moves our understanding of the mysteries of human behavior one giant step forward, a brilliant and convincing book. John has taught at labs at New York University and Yale for many years, and you believe that the unconscious mind has impact on actions that go way beyond what we might perceive, such as race relations. How so?
Absolutely. You know, it wasn't that long ago, but for tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of years, we were basically tribes. We fought other tribes, and it was very dangerous. I mean, the studies of the prehistoric fossils and prehistoric men and women show that something like one out of every four males, or maybe even more than that, one out of every four died by being murdered by another person. And even though we have a lot of crime today, you know, it's not that bad, because we're talking 25 or 30% of adult males, they look at the fossils and everything, died by the hand of another person. And it was a very violent time when tribes were fighting against each other for food and resources. And we still have that tribal mentality inside us. You know, it wasn't that long ago before if people who dressed differently, looked differently, talked differently, showed up on horseback at your village gate, you know, that was not good news. You know, that was not good. It was Attila and his friends or somebody like that. And so we tend not to trust people who don't look like us or talk like us or have the same skin color, who are clearly different from us. And we have that in our genes. That's in our DNA. And the world has moved very quickly, as we all know, technologically and culturally in the last 100 or so, or more than that, 200 years. But our evolutionary changes, the way we're made up in our DNA, you know, it takes 100,000 years for that to change. And so we're never going to catch up in terms of our innate gut kinds of feelings. And this is a real disconnect between the unconscious urges and ideas that we have and present-day life. This is one place where we really have to be careful. When we have a gut impression of somebody who's different from us in some important way, we've got to give them a chance. We can't just assume that our gut is right when we're looking at and dealing with somebody mm-hmm. who's different from us. And that is a disconnect between the old unconscious ideas and impulses that we have and present-day realities, you know, of our present-day life.
Dr. Barge's research indicates that there are influential psychological forces that are at work as we do things like checking a dating app or holding a hot cup of coffee or getting a flu shot. How is this possible?
What is interesting is that the mind sort of evolved or grew from basic physical kinds of sensations and experiences. And the more abstract ways of thinking sort of were built onto those so that those connections still exist. So it's very true that in our infantile experience, you know, we are being held close to the mother during breastfeeding, say, as an infant. Well, there's a combination there of being taken care of by someone, which is someone watching out for you, which is what we call social warmth, someone who has your best interests at heart, and physical warmth, because you're being held close to the body. And so there's a connection there in your mind between physical warmth and social warmth, or being taken care of, and someone's your friend and cares for you. And that association is very strong. And over the eons, actually, it's been built into the brain. It is now hardwired in our brain. The same little walnut-sized part of the brain called the insula reacts both to physical warmth, like a hot cup of coffee, but also when someone does something nice to you or cares for you or smiles at you. The same little part of the brain is active in both cases, and they're connected to each other. So a lot of research has been done since then showing that when people are texting, when their brain is being imaged, so you can see what the activity of the different parts of the brain, right? So when you're texting your family or your friends while you're in the brain magnet, this area becomes active, the social warmth one, because you're dealing with your family and friends. And then if you hold something warm, the same little area lights up. So we have this connection. And it turns out, and I was watching a documentary on the History Channel, on hell, and I actually like to watch documentaries on hell. I don't know why. And so this documentary came on, and it was talking about Dante, the great poet who wrote the Inferno. And I'm watching, this is interesting, but then they get to the worst, lowest level of hell, which is the ninth level, where Satan himself is being punished in the ninth level. And it's not fiery. It's not fire and brimstone. It's a lake, a frozen lake. So the punishment that fits the crime for Satan and the other people there, and the ninth level is for people who betray the trust of others. This is the ultimate in social coldness. Someone that has your trust, and you trust them, and they betray that trust, like Bernie Madoff, right? I used to tell my class, and Bernie Madoff is there in the ninth level, and someone said, he's not dead yet. Oh, yeah, sorry. So that's where they have a place reserved for people like that, who prey on their friends and use the trust that other people have in them. And what is the punishment Dante assigned in the year 1310 A.D.? To be frozen in ice. That was the contrapasso, or the punishment that fit the crime, for social coldness of betrayal, to be frozen forever in ice.
Well, it's a book chock full of all kinds of revelations, including this one, we're more likely to be a germaphobe if we're politically conservative. Is that true?
If there's a tendency for people who are germaphobes, or who find things disgusting and use that word a lot, to have negative attitudes about immigration. And that could be that they're conservative or may not be. I don't think the research is showing that definitely. But there is a connection, though, between a very adaptive tendency to avoid something that's dirty, contaminated, food that smells bad, that looks bad, filled. We don't want to touch it. We don't want to get near it. When that's a good thing, because that's the source of germs that can invade our body. And before there was penicillin, and before they understood how this worked, it could kill us.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with Dr. John Barge, a man recognized as the world's leading expert on the unconscious mind. From 1981 to 2003, he was on the faculty at NYU. He is now a professor of psychology at Yale University with more than 180 publications and elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2011. Congratulations on Before You Know It, The Unconscious Reasons We Do What We Do, Dr. Barge.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you for having me.
And we're back after this brief pause with the remarkable author and journalist Sally Quinn. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is producing. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and your number is 877-217-5757. We're joined by Sally Quinn, author and journalist. She writes a blog about religion for the Washington Post, and she has been around for many years as a commentator and certainly a person of letters, and was married to the remarkable Ben Bradley, who was the force behind Watergate and the Washington Post. And good morning to you, Sally Quinn. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Hi, glad to talk to you.
And I can tell by your voice that you grew up in the southern part of the United States.
Well, darling. You know, if I get very tired or have too much to drink, I suddenly get my southern accent back. I'm from Savannah, Georgia. But we did, my father was in the Army. We did live in Louisiana for a while, and I spent a lot of my summers in Statesboro, Georgia.
Very good. The latest work from Sally is a spiritual memoir. It's called Finding Magic, and I think it certainly has roots in Savannah, Georgia. It's an unusual memoir.
Well, I think that everybody says that. It's not your usual memoir, spiritual memoir. That's for sure. It's very candid and very raw, and, a lot of it is about, I had actually, when I started the religion website at the Post 11 years ago called On Faith, I was an atheist, and I started studying religion, and I started it because I thought that we weren't covering religion and that it was such an important topic, both not in American politics, but also foreign policy. And so when I started the website, it was really for journalistic reasons, but then I started studying religion, reading a lot, traveled around the world to study the great faiths, and I got completely consumed by the idea of religion and faith and completely caught up in it and fascinated by it. And the idea that 95% of the people in this world are informed in some way, you know, by their faith. And so I started rethinking it, and it was just a fascinating time in my life. And, you know, someone reminded me, my husband, Ben Bradley, who was the most sort of energetic, charismatic, dazzling, chivalrous, swashbuckling, sexy guy you've ever met. And Ben got dementia 8 years before he died, which will be 3 years on Saturday since Ben has died. But he got dementia. And the last 2 years of his life, I took care of him. And it was, you know, it was a real eye opener for me, because I had in fact been asked to do a memoir about or a book about how an atheist ever started a religion website, and then Ben started his decline, and I just couldn't write. I didn't do anything, and then after he died, about 3 weeks later, I thought I've really got to write this book, and so I started writing about his dementia and his decline and his death. And then I started thinking, you know, this is really what I want to write about, and not necessarily about the website, which I didn't have that much to, you know, I mean, it was okay. I do write about it in the book, but it became more of my spiritual experience throughout my life, and the sort of road I took from childhood with just story after story after story of things that happened to me in my life that were moments of transcendence or epiphanies, or moments of illumination, or spiritual moments, or moments of magic. I mean, I call my book Finding Magic because it was clear when I finally worked my way up to where I had the website that all my life I had not really been an atheist at all. I had believed in spirituality or magic or whatever. Some people might want to call it God. I think everybody has a different word for God, and I mean, certainly the thousands of people I've interviewed about religion, I always ask them what God is to them, and everyone has a different view.
Well, when you say you believe in magic, Sally, what does that mean?
Well, what that means is that I believe, you know, a lot of people have given up organized religion these days and are going, they're what they call nuns, N-O-N-E-S, which means if you ask someone what their religion is, they say none. But they will always say they're spiritual. They're only about 1% of people who are actual atheists. I call them SBNR, spiritual but not religious. And so people, I think, particularly now, when the world is in such chaos, are looking for spirituality, and they're looking for meaning, and they're looking for some, why are we here? What is this all about? And they're not getting what they need from the organized religions, and so they're going elsewhere for it. And so when people will pray, some people pray to God, and some people send prayers out to the universe or whatever they want to do. But when I talk about magic, it's what some people might want to call God or Allah or Zeus or whatever you might want to call it. But it is something that gives you a sense of transcendence and a sense of being in touch with the divine. And a sense of taking that there is something bigger than we are, and something that's mysterious that we just can't know. I mean, some sense of enchantment in our lives. And so for me, it was always about, as I look back on my life when I was writing the book, I saw that there were these moments all the way through my life that I hadn't recognized for being what they were. I just saw them as, you know, moments. And it was only after I started writing the book and wrote about Ben's death, and then went back and started looking at my life, that I realized that I had not been an atheist, that I had been a very spiritual person all of my life. And certainly the last 2 years of Ben's life when I took care of him were the most spiritual moments, the most spiritual time of my life, and in an mm-hmm. odd way, the happiest time of our marriage, because we grew closer, and I was so lucky that Ben knew me up until the very end, and so mm-hmm. He had his personality. You know, he was confused. He couldn't take a shower by himself. I had to show him how to brush his teeth. I had to get him dressed and undressed, and he would have these blackouts and these psychotic episodes. But he knew who I was, and he didn't lose his personality. He was confused, and he had trouble with conversation. And so we still had this wonderful relationship, and we were still, I mean, we were together 43 years. I was madly in love with him the whole time.
Well, there was
we were together, and I was more in love with him the day he died than I had ever been before.
When you met, there was some magic there, and of course, it's a legendary story. How did you meet?
Well, we actually, an editor who had hired me at the Post brought me in to meet Ben, and who was the editor of the Post at that time, and I was just completely dazzled. I was just stunned, and, but he was 20 years older, and he was the editor of the paper, and I was in my 20s, the job didn't work out. I never worked at the Post, and then about 2 years later, I had been the social secretary for the Algerian ambassador, and so Ben knew me, and he had just started Style, the Style, the Revolutionary Style section, and so he called and asked me if I wanted to be a reporter, a party reporter, and so I went in for an interview, and it was, I just was, again, electrified, dazzled by this incredible man, but still, he was this godlike creature, Mr. Bradley,
mm-hmm.
but we had this sort of very interesting, there was a lot of electricity in the room, and a lot of sparring back and forth, and a lot of, we were obviously attracted to each other, but nothing ever happened until 4 years later, when we were on the plane going down to Miami to cover the convention, and we were seated next to each other by accident. And we later admitted to each other that I fell in love with him on that flight, that two-hour flight to Miami, and he had later admitted he had fallen in love with me. But that was right in the middle of Watergate, and it was just too dangerous for anything to happen. I was writing him these little anonymous notes, kind of little love notes, after we'd have some encounter in the newsroom, and he never figured out who was sending the notes. Men can be so stupid sometimes.
Really?
But I realized that I couldn't approach him, and one of my friends said, "You can't do this, because if he takes you up on this, you will, you could bring down the newspaper, you could, and it would end the Watergate investigation, and Ben was being followed, and his phones were tapped, and all of that." And he said, you have to put your country first. And being an army brat, duty, honor, country, that was the one thing he could have said that kept me away from Ben. And so I, in order to get away from him, I accepted a job at CBS News to be the first network anchor woman and moved to New York and was miserable. And by that time, Ben and I had gotten together. I told him I had lunch with him, and a farewell lunch, and I told him I was in love with him, and he said, "I can't believe you're saying this, because I've been in love with you for the last year." And so we ended up being together, and we were together for the rest of our lives.
43 years.
Well, 43 years, yeah.
It's a great book, and certainly an unconventional and, in its own way, inspiring memoir from Sally Quinn, who is the subject of 6 portraits by Andy Warhol. So you've had a full,
yes,
a full life. But Finding Magic is the book, and we certainly appreciate the time you spent with us this morning. Thank you, Sally.
Okay, thank you so much.
Take care, and see you soon.
Bye.
And tomorrow we'll be back, same time, same place, and we'll visit with Walt Leger, the leader of the House Democratic Caucus. Actually, Gene Reynolds has that, but Walt is a speaker pro tem, and we have some conversations to go with him about the fiscal cliff. So until tomorrow, for Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.